Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Ugly Things Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Staggs. For this episode, I talked to Dirv Gordon, lead singer of one of the great British bands of the late 60s and early 70s, The Equals. The Equals' place in pop culture history has come to be defined by the commercial success of songs like Baby Come Back, I Get So Excited, and Viva Bobby Joe, but their catalog runs much deeper, revealing a dynamism and diversity that goes way beyond the bubblegum label that some have attempted to affix to them. Over the years, their records sifted and blended elements of rock, soul, ska, funk, blues, pop, freakbeat, psychedelia, glam, reggae, and bubblegum. A sound that was always evolving, always different, yet always unmistakably The Equals. Dirv Gordon's soulful voice and dynamic stage presence was a huge element in the band's success. He's still performing today and sounds as fantastic as ever. Not only that, he's a genuinely great guy and always a pleasure to chat with. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did.
Let's get into this. So you and your brother Lincoln were born in Jamaica, obviously. You lived there until you were 7 years old. So what do you remember about your life in Jamaica?
Little bits, really. It was quite, as far as I was concerned, it was quite idyllic because my parents came to the UK when I was probably about 4 years old. So therefore, we went to live on a farm in the country with relatives, and it was quite idyllic, really. It was, we had no sort of immediate neighbours, so it was quite a large farm, and all sort of animals and stuff were on there, and they were really kind to us, so I didn't miss my parents as much as you would think that I would, really.
Yeah, that must have been really nice, actually.
It was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful, idyllic. And the thing is, I probably didn't appreciate it at the time until after we've left, you know, because it was free, you know. There was lots of fruit trees that they grew just about everything. Most of what was grown there is what we ate. It's all natural stuff, no fertilizer or anything like that. And there was also a farm shop as well. So different people from the areas would be popping in and popping out, you know. And we were treated really well. I had no complaints at all.
Yeah.
And then from there we came to London.
Yeah. So tell me about that. That would have been the 50s.
Well,
early
I can remember 50s. The first day. I remember coming off the plane, and it was December, and it was snowing. I've never seen snow before because obviously you don't have snow in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go back on the plane. I thought, even though my father had told us that, he sent us clothes for the winter. He sent us winter clothes because in the Caribbean, in Jamaica, I mean, all you would wear is just a shirt and a pair of short trousers, really.
Yeah.
That was it. So I remember him writing a letter and saying that he's sending us a cardigan. And I thought, cardigan? What the hell is a cardigan? So I had a dictionary, so I had to look it up and see, oh, okay, do we need that? And he also mentioned that when you open the refrigerator door, that's basically how it feels in the winter in Europe. So, okay. But the plane landed, and the door opened, and whoosh, this it was like opening a refrigerator door. And there was this white stuff coming down. And I thought, oh, I don't like this. I'm going to get back on the plane. But obviously, that's not possible. And then our father met us. And driving from Heathrow Airport to our home in Islington, it was snowing. As I said, there was snow on the ground. And I saw smoke coming out of these buildings, the top of these buildings. And I thought, why are these buildings all on fire? I've never seen anything like it before. It was very rare to have anything higher than a bungalow in the Caribbean. You know, you didn't have two stories or three stories or four story buildings then, you know, in the 50s.
Oh, yeah.
So it was all very odd. But being with my parents now, then, you know, made things different then. You felt differently. I was happy because I wanted to be with them. So I didn't miss Jamaica as much as I thought I would do, because being with the parents, I mean, everything is back to normal for the family.
How about adjusting to, like, going to school and making friends with other kids and things like that?
I had no problems, really. Because in the 50s, we were sort of like novelties, really, because we were the only blacks in our school for a couple of years. You know, I went to a primary school. We were the only, myself and my brother, and my sister were the only black children in that school. We didn't really have any sort of major problems. No different to any other kids. Made friends easily. We were sort of a novelty, really. You know, I mean, because most of the kids had never seen a black child before, or a black person before.
Yeah, so it was a novelty for them, but in a good way. Like, you're interesting and different, and you know, we want to get to know you or whatever.
That's right. Everyone wanted to be your friend, you know, and that was good. And what I discovered with school, because I went to school briefly in Jamaica. And I was bullied there in a way, because being born in Kingston and going to the country, your accent is different. They know that you're not from that area. And oddly enough, I was told to go back where I came from. which was strange, really, which in a way has made me feel like a foreigner for all of my life, really. I never lived in where I was born for more than a few years. It's odd, really.
Yeah. So when did you first start becoming interested in music and then actually wanting to make music?
Well, I first became interested in music because on the farm where we were living, there was a little church. And it was a lot of the services involved singing. So I enjoyed singing there. I had a little drum, and I would play the little drum. So as far as I can remember, I've been interested in music.
Yeah.
And we also had a radio, and on the radio, you could get a lot of the stations that were on there were from Cuba or from Florida. So, you know, we had all the jazz music on the radio, blues, rock and roll. I mean, I was a great Little Richard's fan. Pat's Domino, Chuck Berry, you know.
Yeah.
So, as far back as I can remember, I've loved music. I even tried making a guitar out of a sardine tin. You stick a piece of bamboo in it and try to play that. Or you can also make music with a wood saw as well, depending on how you bend it.
Yeah.
It makes it a really nice sound. So I've always been interested in music.
Right, and was Lincoln the same?
Yeah.
So how did go on. Well, I was going to say, how did it come to be that you met the other band members and started to put the band together?
Well, John Hall, the drummer, his mother wanted to keep him out of trouble, so he wanted to be a musician, so she encouraged him. But he couldn't find anyone to join his band. So I had a friend who lived across the road from me, and he had a guitar, and he said to me that he's got a look, he's got a band, but they need some more members. And a guy called Eddie, not Eddie Grant, another Eddie.
Yeah.
So myself and my brother, we bought a guitar as well. And he took us to meet John Hall. And at the same time, Eddie Grant was there. But John Hall and Eddie Grant went to the same school.
Right.
They didn't know each other at school. But a friend of John introduced them together. So we decided, okay, we'll form a band. The guy who took me there, after a couple of weeks, he was able to play the guitar, whereas myself, I wasn't very good at it. Lincoln was better at it than me, and Eddie was okay as well. But so he decided, this other Eddie person decided that he would take a break for a couple of months while we catch up with him. Big mistake.
And that's the last we heard from him.
And I saw him. I saw him shortly after Baby Come Back was in the charts. We met in a club, and he wasn't very pleasant towards me. But I mean, it wasn't my fault that he left. I mean, his argument was that we threw him out, but we didn't throw him out. He left. He said he wanted to take a break until we catch up. And so that was myself, John, Eddie, and Lincoln. So we needed another guitarist because, as I said, the person had left. And shortly after that, I was in a club near John Hall's home, a youth club. There were loads of youth clubs in London. You know, every night you could go, apart from Sundays or Saturday, you could go to a different youth club. Sadly, they don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And I was with some friends, and Pat Lloyd was with some friends. For some reason, Pat Lloyd's friends didn't like my friends. So they started to argue and whatever. And oddly enough, I just started to talk to Pat. And he asked me, what do I like? So I said, well, I've got a band, you know, showing off now. But it wasn't really even, you know, we just had some practice sessions for about 6 months. So I said, okay, you know, I'm in band. So he says, oh, that's funny. He says, my father's just bought me a guitar, you know. I said, okay, we're short of a guitarist. So, you know, come. Why don't you come along? And there you go. That was the forming of the Equals.
Wow. So in the beginning, there's no bass player?
No, there was no bass. There was just guitars and drums. So my guitar playing was not very good. So they decided that I should be the singer instead.
Right.
So, okay. Because I enjoyed singing. I sang all the time. I mean, it's true what people say about singing in a bath and all sorts of things like that, you know. Everywhere I was singing all these Fats Domino's, Little Richard songs, blues songs, you know, to myself,
right.
Not to anyone. And one night I went to a friend of mine had a band, and they were playing in a pub in Finsbury Park. And he asked me to come along, so I went along. And the next thing I know, he called me up on the stage. And I started singing, and I thought, I like this. Oh, wow. Yeah, this is it, you know. People applauding, you know.
Yeah.
I like it. And my career started as a singer.
So what was the repertoire in the beginning? Was it what you were saying, like Fats Domino and Chuck Berry and stuff like that?
Yeah. We were mainly sort of, it was mainly, and soul stuff as well, James Brown, Motown stuff as well.
Right.
And then we decided we weren't very good at it. You know, we thought, people might say that you're not very good. Because we used to play in these little youth clubs, you know, and it was okay. But then we decided it would be better if we wrote our own songs. Because if you write your own songs, people can't say you play it badly.
Yeah.
It's yours, you know, it's how you want it to go. So, then the writing starts.
Well, what were the first songs? Do you remember what the first songs were?
The first songs were I Won't Be There was one.
Yeah.
Baby Come Back was one. Hold Me Closer was one. On the first album, the Unequaled Equals album, those were the first songs.
Right, so right out of the gate, you were coming up with great songs.
No, but some were rejected. I mean, those were the ones that were chosen.
Oh, those were the,
also,
yeah.
injected on there were some other Giddy Up and Ding Dong and things like that. Because President Record was also, the man who owned President Record also owned Casino Music, which was the publisher's. And he published those songs that we recorded that were written by us.
Right.
On there, because he's getting the publishing royalties from those. And the production on the album as well wasn't, it's produced by Eddie Kaufman, but it isn't.
Right.
So it was a guy working for Decca Records, but he couldn't claim the production thing because he was a Decca producer.
Right.
So we had to record one of his songs as well. But how it came about us getting the recording contract, we normally practice at John Old's home because his parents didn't mind the noise, and the neighbors, they were great. They didn't mind it either. But one night we decided that we'd rehearse at Eddie Grant's house. And next door to Eddie Grant was a guy living there. He was a singer. His name was Gene Latter. And he heard us playing the songs that we'd written. And he knocked on the door. He came in and he said, told us that he's a singer. And he likes the songs that we're playing. Were they our songs? Because he'd never heard these songs before. We said, yes, they're our songs. And he said he would like to record some of them. We said, okay. He said that he knows the boss of the record company, President Records, and he could arrange an audition where we could perform, play the songs for him, to Eddie Kasner, to see if he likes them, and maybe he'd be able to get himself a recording contract. So we said, okay, fine. So we set up a meeting. We went to Denmark Street, where President Record was located, and we started to perform the songs to the boss, Eddie Kasner. And he said, well, I like these songs.
Well, I'm a poor man, and I can't afford the best things in life. Yes, I'm a poor man, babe, and that's the way I gotta spend my life.
So we performed about five songs, and he said, you're having them all. So sort of looked at each other and said, yes, we have more. So he says, okay, I'm going off to America, because he went off to America two or three times a year. So I'm going off to America, and when I come back, you know, if you have some more of these songs, I would like to record it. But I don't want Gene Latter to be the vocalist. I want you, Derv, to be the vocalist. So I said, oh. So really bad for about 2 seconds. So we recorded the first album on Unequaled Equals.
Wow. So Gene Latter, his idea of, you know, having a hit with some of your songs was completely backfired on him, that idea.
Well, it did, because he said he had a hit in Belgium with a Rolling Stone song called Mother's Little Helper.
Yeah.
I think it got in the top 100 or something like that. But he was well known around the music business.
Yeah.
Because on the first recording sessions, he came to the studio, actually, even though he was quite upset, because he wanted part of the management of our group, because we didn't really have a manager. And he wanted part of the management. But with Eddie Kasner, it's all or nothing. Eddie Kasner doesn't share anything with anyone, you know. So he paid him off because he was really upset. I saw him shortly after that. He was drunk and, you know, he was swearing and saying, yeah, I sold you out for 500 quid. And, yeah. You know. We stayed sort of friends afterwards, you know. He did record later some of our songs, like I Get So Excited and so on.
So while Eddie Kasner was taking the Queen Mary to America and back or whatever, you had to come up with the rest of the album. That was it, right?
Yeah.
So going back to the Equals the first thing you did was an album. Before you even had a hit single, you had a hit album.
Got to number 8 in the UK charts.
Right.
And charted in Europe and so on. And that was a great feeling, because about a mile away from my home was a record shop that we used to go. And we would get records on credit, because you couldn't buy enough, pay for an old album. So we'd let you have it. And then we'd take a couple of weeks and you'd pay for it. And when the Unequal Equals was in the charts, he plastered the whole front of the shop with the album. You know, I used to go there and sort of stand outside the shop, you know, anybody recognize him? Yeah, it was a great feeling. Yeah.
But you started having hit singles first in Germany, starting with I Won't Be There. How did that come about? Why was that?
Well, I Won't Be There got in the German charts. So we were invited to do Beat Club. And Beat Club, just about every kid in Germany watched Beat Club.
Yeah.
And there was a disc jockey there at a club, a disco, in Bremen, where Beat Club is recorded. And he was a great lover of the Equals stuff. So we had I Won't Be There. And then after that, they released Hold Me Closer as the A-side, and Baby Come Back as the B-side. And he was a very influential disc jockey, this guy in the club in Bremen. Disc jockeys all over Germany would listen to the stuff that he plays. And he said he would prefer he prefers Baby Come Back. So everyone, all the clubs started playing Baby Come Back, and not so much Hold Me Closer. And it shot up into the German chart. And then from Germany, German charts was influenced charts in Holland, Switzerland, France, and all over Europe. You know, so it became a hit, but not in the UK. And then it was released again in the UK, got in the charts, got in the top 30 one week, and then dropped back out. And then the following week, back in it came, and then just climbed up to number one.
Wow. I knew it. Just thought Baby Come Back was just kind of a throwaway, right? Just the B-side. Hold Me Closer was the one you thought that was going to take off.
Yeah.
Which is a great record.
Well, it wasn't our choice. I mean, everything, the choice is of Freddy Kasner, what his A-side and what his B-side.
Yeah.
Originally. But as I said, the discos were very influential with the charts in Germany and Europe. So the guy flipped it, said, no, I prefer this one. And then we got an invite back to Beat Club again to do Baby Come Back, Police on My Back, I Get So Excited, Softly Soft. We were doing Beat Club probably 3 or 4 times a year.
Yeah,
all different tracks.
Yeah, I mean, you were huge in Germany. That was your biggest market, right?
Yeah, and the producer liked us. I don't know why he liked us. So, and he was a nice person, and you didn't normally find that a lot with TV producers and that. You know, most of them are still really distant. You know, you don't really see them, but he was on the ball.
So, yeah, I mean, let's talk about visually. You guys had a very distinctive image. You know, let's talk about the clothes and the style that you guys had. You were very colorful compared with, you know, a lot of the other bands out there. Yeah, how did that come about?
I think being from the Caribbean, when I first came to England, the thing that I found most depressing was everything was gray. You know, there was no color. You know, everything was just gray. And you have this Caribbean theme with colors, you know, because you have flowers that are colourful, clothes are colourful, and the 60s is brilliant because the 50s was really drab, really, you know, clothes-wise, it was really drab. But then in the 60s, like, anything goes, you know. I mean, who would have thought in the 50s that somebody would be wearing a pink suit? A man would be wearing a pink suit, you know, or a pink shirt, you know, or red trousers, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was unheard of in the 50s, but in the 60s, we sort of broke barriers.
Yeah, you were the trailblazers for that because even, you know, the Beatles and the Stones, they were wearing sort of dark, you know, grey suits and, you know, grey clothes.
They're not from the Caribbean. Lincoln and Eddie are from the Caribbean. And the funny thing is, John was like somebody from the Caribbean as well. He loved the same sort of music. He loved ska, blue beat, you know, all the stuff that we loved as well. And that was brilliant. That made it even more exciting. And we would try to outdo each other on clothes as well. You know?
Right.
Apart from our first television outfit, which was like something from Star Trek, I think. We all wore the same clothes, and I thought, I don't like wearing the same clothes as everybody else, you know. I have my own thing. So, you know, that's how it started. It was like a big competition. And not far from where I lived was a tailor who was Italian, and they love colours, you see. So if I would ask him, could I have a shirt made in that colour? Could I have trousers made in that colour? Oh, I'll get the material. And it wasn't a problem, you see?
Yeah.
And then you had Carnaby Street as well, where things started to really change there. I mean, things became very colourful there as well, you know.
Right, but yeah, but Carnaby Street, a lot of the stuff was more mass-produced, right? And you would...
Well, I wasn't into the... Well, yeah, but just off Carnaby Street, there was a little shop called Carnaby Cavern, and the guy there, he was an ex-dancer. So, he had, you know, when you mentioned something to with flair and so on, it was not a problem. And you'd go in the morning, you're off to a gig, you'd tell him what you want, you go off to the gig, you come back the next day, and it was made, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if you went into a normal clothes place and said that I wanted a pink shirt, they would think that, you know, you just come out of a mental hole or something, you know, whereas to him, you know, no, why don't you have some frills in it as well, you know?
Yeah. So let's talk next about, he finally broke out with a hit single in the UK, which was I Get So Excited. So what do you remember about that? You wrote that with Eddie, right?
Yeah. I wrote that, actually, because, you know, you're driving along, and I used to get into trouble with this with children when I first got married. And you're looking at what's happening on the pavement, you know, and in the 60s, and there was lots of beautiful, London had a lot of beautiful women, you know, or still do, really, you know. So, you know, you think, oh, wow, yeah, yeah. Oh, I see you walking. But I had tunes coming in my head all the time, you know. I would be up 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, you know. And sometimes you'd get a line, and then you couldn't follow that line, and I couldn't sleep until I get a line to follow that line. And I used to enjoy songwriting. I haven't written a song for years, but I used to enjoy songwriting. You know, it's fun.
Oh, yeah, well, especially when then you can take it to the band, and you see it come to life. I mean, there's nothing... It's one of the most fulfilling things, isn't it? You know, seeing...
And it was also a bit of a competition as well, you know? I mean... And sometimes, instead of when you're on tour, instead of going off to a disco and or whatever, which you were always invited to, myself and Eddie and Lincoln would lock ourselves in our room and write songs.
Right.
And then you would have a meeting with President, with Kirshner. You'd present the songs and he'd say yes, no, yes, no. And sometimes he made good choices, sometimes he didn't. But... he was the boss, I mean, you know.
Right, right, so he thought he knew best. So sometimes...
I'm sure that we threw away some stuff that were quite good songs, but never got recorded, but... That's life, that's how it goes.
Yeah, right. Well, let me throw some other song titles at you. And Softly, Softly, that was a, you know, a real crowd pleaser, right?
Yeah, it's not what you think, Mike, you know. Hold on, I'm coming. Yeah, you know, it's like the you know, it's Simon Davis. Hold on, tell me.
Yeah, there was always a lot of...
the double meaning. No. Honestly.
I love how there was always a spontaneous sort of shouting between you and Eddie going on during the songs, and I suppose Lincoln as well, right? Like, just these ad-libs.
I did a lot of ad-libbing. I mean, it annoys me sometimes when I see a song and it says, you know, written by Eddie Grant. Because 50% of it was either something myself and Lincoln threw in there but never got credited for. But, you know, that's how it is.
Yeah, right. But yeah, it gives you, all your songs have this sort of infectious, I mean, it sounds like you're having a great time while you're recording them and while you're performing them. And that's, you know, when you listen to a record like that, that makes you feel the same way, you know?
Well, I used to love recording during the night. I didn't like recording during the day. You know, I loved recording during the night. And 90% of the time, it would only be the band in the studio, you know. And I would do a guide vocal, so that the drums, drum, bass, rhythm can get the song to lay the foundation. And then later on, I would do the lead vocal. But sometimes they would keep the backing vocal because I couldn't better it, you know.
Yeah.
So that was okay. And then I would do backing vocals as well with Eddie and Lincoln, as mostly. John didn't do any singing. Pat did very little. It was basically myself, Eddie and Lincoln, really.
Tell me about Michael and His Slipper Tree. That's one of the catchiest songs I think that's ever been written.
That was Lincoln and Eddie's idea, and it's based on a Caribbean nursery rhyme about a nutmeg tree. There's no way you could sing Michael and his nutmeg tree. It sounds stupid, but for some reason Slipper came up and took off from there. Michael and his slipper tree.
Yeah, nothing goofy about a slipper tree, you know.
No, it's funny. It's one of my son's favourite songs. You know, my grandson as well. You know, oh, love Michael. People love this that song. And it's also like a football chant as well. You know, especially the bit I go, Michael. You know, everybody loves singing that.
Yeah, you kind of forced to sing along and clap and stomp, you know, it's just got that feeling, yeah. Yeah, Viva Bobby Joe is another one that was like that, you know, very much like sort of a football anthem.
That's right, but Bobby Joe, it started off as Bobby Joe, and I said, no, there's something wrong here, you know, just Bobby Joe. I said, no, that doesn't make sense. I said, what is it in Mexico, you know, Spain, you know, when somebody's in a race, because it's about a guy riding a bicycle, you know. So what is it, you know, when somebody's won, you know, a race, you know, the crowd shouts Viva, and everyone said, yeah, that's it, Viva Bobby Joe, that's it, there you go, Viva Bobby Joe.
And you actually it was short for a while there, it was Viva Bobby Moore, right after the Great,
well, no, that's when West Ham Football Club took that over, and they started singing it as one of their anthems.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so, and then the president invited Bobby Moore down to the studio to do a photo shoot, and he came along. And, I mean, he was the only England captain to have won the World Cup, really.
Yeah.
That was in 66, and this was in 69. So he was still a great hero, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
And he turned up in Denmark Street, and he was driving MGB. And I said to him, I said, nice guy. I said, I've got one of those. He looked at me with a little smile on his face. He says, it's the missus's. It's not mine. The wife's car. I felt, oh, okay. He was a really nice man. So after that, I went out and bought a Aston Martin instead.
Wow. Yeah, so you guys were making some pretty good money. And you know, there wasn't a lot of, like, young, you know, West Indian guys that were driving around in these flash cars in London at the time. I mean, that must have been...
No, I mean, I had some stories then. Some people would, you know, would look at you and smile. Coming onto Oxford Street one day with Jude, and I stopped so that people could cross, and a man with a bowler hat, an umbrella, and he looked at me, looked at the car, and whacked the bonnet of the car with his umbrella and walked on.
Something about that really upset him, huh?
Oh, it didn't really upset me, you know. I mean, I take these things. I don't go on and, you know, mope about it. Because then you had people who would look at you and smile, you know? And people would say, oh, well done. And, like, when you have, like, the Aston Martin, I mean, everybody wanted to challenge you to a race, you know? Yeah, the traffic lights and boom, 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 yeah. Look, it's a Ford something out there, right? Boom, boom, and they're looking at you. The Aston would do 50 miles an hour in first gear, you know? My mother was terrified of driving in it, you know? She said, you're trying to kill me. I said, no, Mum. Just a fast car. And in that argument with Jude as well, she didn't, the first one, she didn't like at all, you know?
Okay. Yeah, no, so yeah, you'd only just learned to drive and you were already driving these really flash cars, right?
Yeah, but the problem with that as well is that the insurance was almost impossible to get insurance. What we had to do was to get insured through the musicians' union, because the insurance company's argument was that if you're driving your car, you're a showbiz person, yeah, and the person, your passenger, might be also a famous person as well. And if you have an accident and this person claimed it could turn out to be thousands and thousands of pounds, but they wouldn't insure you. And sometimes the insurance on the car costs almost as much as to buy the car.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about that.
If you want it, that's what you have to do.
Well, I mean, well, this brings us, of course, to the Equals were in a pretty serious car accident in Germany, 1969.
Yeah.
Can you tell that story for us?
That was the band's... Bentley. And to this day, I'm still thinking as to why we had our car in Germany. Because normally you would fly in and transport would be laid on for you. But on this occasion, we were doing a show the night before in a town called Bielefeld. And from there, the next, we were meant to be driving up to Bremen to do a beat club on Viva Bobby Joe. And we did a great gig the night before, really enjoyable. Got up in a great mood, had breakfast, managed to get John out of bed, which was normally difficult. Sometimes we had to wheel his bed out into the hallway before he would get out of it.
He was the only drinker in the band, right?
Yeah, but he didn't drink to excess. Nobody really drank to excess, really.
Yeah.
He'd have the odd drink. We'd have a little nibble at, I think there was a tablet called Purple House or something. But no, there was no sort of heavy drinking.
Okay.
We all smoked apart from Eddie. And, but John just had this thing about getting out of bed. You know, he just couldn't get him out. So eventually got him out of bed, had breakfast, got in the car. Our driver, Mike Parrish, who, oddly enough, after leaving us, went to drive and work for Stevie Wonder. But we were going along and suddenly it started raining and really coming down heavy. And the next thing I know, the car was just turning over and over and over because we'd gone down into like a gully. It's true what they say about when you're in a situation like that, your whole life flashes in front of you. And I remember coming out, I was thrown out of the car, and on the grass in Knoll, I could hear this person going, oh, I'm dying. I'm in pain, I'm dying. And it was Eddie. And he was impaled on this barbed wire because it was like a farm. And he was impaled on this barbed wire. We managed to get him down. I took off my beloved leather jacket, red and cream leather jacket, and covered him. Oh, that ruined that. There was blood all over that. And we're sort of just wandering around. And there's this car with the four wheels up in the air. The driver, Mick Parrish, is running around like a headless chicken, mumbling. And a British lorry, army lorry, was coming past because it was in the British part of, because Germany was divided up into sections, you know?
Right.
British, French, American, and German, and Russian.
Yeah.
So we were in the British part. A British lorry was coming past. They saw the car. They recognized the car was a Bentley. And they could see us, so they realized that we're British. And they put us on the lorry, the army lorry, and took us to a private hospital. And when we got to the private hospital, the big problem there is they wanted to know if we could pay for treatment. And our driver goes, of course they can pay for treatment. It's the Equals. Oh, the Equals. And someone telephoned England. And it came on Radio 1 that we were involved in an accident and there's possibly fatalities. Now, I'd not long been married and Jude was pregnant and she was staying with my mother at the time. And they both heard that on the radio. And she fainted, you know, because she thought we were dead.
But you were all okay except for Eddie, right?
No, Lincoln had got two broken fingers. Sort of packed, and I had a little cut on one finger, and John was okay. But the odd thing about that is that we normally, group are very territorial, you know, on transport. You know, you always sit in the same seat.
Yeah.
And for some, Eddie asked me to change seat with him on that particular day, and I reluctantly said, yeah, okay, you know, I'll go in the middle, you can have my seat. Because he wanted to read, because in the back of the Bentley was, you had lights then. You know, in expensive cars, you had lights in at the back.
Yeah.
And he wanted to read. So I said, okay. So if I was sitting there where he was sitting, I would have probably ended up where he did. Yeah.
So what was the extent of his injuries?
The barbed wire caught him between his leg, his groin, in his groin area, and a deep cut there. And he was in hospital there in Germany for two weeks and then came back to the UK. And then when he came back to the UK, he had to go to hospital and they found that he had a problem with his heart. So we were off the road for a couple of months. We never got to do Viva Bobby Joe and Beat Club, strangely enough.
You probably lost a little momentum there, you know.
Well, we didn't want to work without him. And it took me a long time, really, to get used to traveling again on the road, being driven by someone, you know? There was always this little tension there whenever, you know, I got in the car. And we were working, you know, six, seven nights a week, really. You know? There was a lot of traveling involved. You'd start off with a tour that's supposed to be a two-week tour, and it ended up to be a six-week tour.
Let's go back to some of the records. I Can See But You Don't Know. That one wasn't a hit, but what an amazing, amazing record that is.
I would have bet anything I had that that song would have been a hit. And it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't.
Yeah, it was, and it's different from anything you'd done up to that point. It was, it really had a special vibe to it. Yeah.
That and Diversion as well. Diversion, right. I thought would have been a hit as well.
Yeah, another fabulous song that completely slipped through the cracks.
Yeah.
I mean, not long after that, you change your direction and another killer record, Black Skin Blue Eyed Boys.
Yes.
Tell me what you remember about that one.
I remember everything about that one. I could even remember the session, actually. We went in the studio, and we did it in one night. And how the beginning, the OK, I'm loosened up now, children, that was never part of the song. That was just, we was in the studio, and there were too many people in the studio. And there was just doing some overdubbing and so on. And I was getting really peeved. And I said, listen, come on, you know, I want to do my lead vocals now. You know, time for the lead vocals. So I got behind the microphone, looked at everyone in the box, and said, okay, I'm loosened up now, children.
Okay, I'm loosened up now, children. Wow!
Everyone shouted, yeah, that's it. That's it. It was picked up by, we got a TV show on ITV. I don't know if you remember comedian, disc jockey comedian, a guy called Kenny Everett.
Of course, yeah.
And Kenny heard the song and said, I want that on my show. And he had a very popular show that went on early in the evening. We went on there, we did it live, and bam, you know, up it went into the charts. Then Top of the Pops picked it up. And that's it.
Fantastic
and
song,
it's been covered by a number of people. And one of the most pleasing ones is the cover is the Massey Shoals horn.
Oh, yeah.
They do a cover of it, which I really like. They ain't got no country. They ain't got no creed. People won't be black or white. The world will be a breed. The world will be a breed. The world will be a breed. You see the black skin, blue-eyed boys. They ain't gonna fight no wars. We had a lot of difficulties trying to get President Record to get behind it, you know, because at first they said it's the lyrics, you know, it's too controversial. So we said, okay, we are going to pay for the recording, which you do anyway, because at the end of the day, it comes out of your royalties anyway, you know.
Yeah.
The one who thinks that they're recording and they're not paying for it, you know, and if the record's released, they're wrong. It comes out of your royalties.
Yeah, it's funny. I guess President were just afraid of the controversy, yeah. Of, you know, the fact that it was, you know, for like
yeah, but the
black
problem
rights
as well, being a multiracial band as well, you know, that caused problems at times as well. But nothing that we didn't overcome.
Right.
In the beginning, people said, no, it won't work, you know, you're either a black band or a white band or whatever, you know, you can't be mixed. But 90% of my friends were white, so it wasn't odd to me.
Yeah.
With John or Pat. You know, because it was like most of my other friends, you know.
Right, I mean, it was never a problem, I think, for your fans or for the kind of people that came to see you play. It was
no.
It was more a problem for the older generation that didn't.
I think so. I mean, I can't honestly say that we faced any sort of outward racism. I would be lying if I said. The only time I sort of noticed something like that was in Belgium. We were doing, we did a lot of shows in Belgium. And on one particular show, I noticed that the boys that came up for autographs would go to the white members, to the two white members mostly, than the black members. But apart from that, you know, I mean, if anything, I think more people came to the blacks than to the whites. You know, but I never looked at it as John being white or Pat being white. I mean, they were just people that I knew and grew up with. John's parents, his mother was very progressive. She was a lovely lady, very encouraging. She paid for the equipment, our first equipment. We had it on credit, and she signed it because we're all underage. She signed for the HP agreement. And we paid her back, you know, from the little gigs that we did. And she was very encouraging because she was so happy to see John not being in trouble, you know, because he was a bit of a wild boy, John.
Yeah.
They all loved my parents as well. My dad wasn't very encouraging. I mean, I thought I should go to university or college or whatever.
Yeah.
Music isn't, you know, a profession that you can live on, you know. But
right, of course.
Proved him wrong. My mum signed our contract.
So then I guess the next thing that really happened was there was some disputes with President Records, and eventually, like, Eddie left the band. I mean, how did it all kind of, all that stuff go
well,
down?
There was a dispute with President because we asked for an increase in royalties. And because our first contract was illegal. Our first contract was wholesale, which was illegal. It should have been retail. Because wholesale, being paid on wholesale instead of retail is a big difference.
Sure, yeah.
A record company will buy a make a record for 10 pence, okay? Sell it for 20 pence. Whereas in the shop, it's sold for £2. So what we should be paid for royalties is for the shop. So we eventually got that sorted out. And we just got fed up with President because, you know, that was the problem with the Black Skin Blue-Eyed Boys and the rest. It was just one problem after another. And we got an incredible offer from CBS Records. So we took that offer, but we were still under contract with President. And we got sued. And they cost us a lot of money, but we still ended up with a lot of money anyway from the deal. And we had to record some rock and roll material for President Records. That was part of the deal, as well as paying back some money.
Right.
So this is why we recorded the rock and roll, two rock and roll albums, Volume 1 and 2. And a number of the songs, and they were published by Casino Music, which is President, as well. But we wrote some of the songs in that as well. And after the accident in 69, Eddie wasn't quite himself anymore. I mean, he didn't really enjoy traveling. He said it was too much. He was feeling tired. And his idea was that he would leave the band because he didn't want to tour anymore. And he would still continue to write, and we would go off and perform. And I thought, no, that's not a good idea. If you're out of the band, you're out of the band. You know, that's it.
Yeah.
So when I saw in Mojo magazine a few weeks ago, well, I didn't even read it. Somebody told me that he said he was thrown out of the band. Complete nonsense. He was never thrown out of the band. He left the band. But Eddie tends to exaggerate anyway about anything and everything. But, yeah, that's it. He left.
And then Jimmy Haynes was his replacement.
Yeah, but Jimmy wasn't. Jimmy is a great musician, but not the easiest of person to get on with. You know, his lifestyle was totally opposite to mine.
In what way?
I don't really want to go into it. Look, let's put it this way. I don't take drugs, okay?
Yeah. Enough said, yeah.
I find that working with people that do take drugs can be very, very difficult. You know, every time you record something, you're not happy with it, want to record it again and again and again and again, and just work on and on. On stage wise, he didn't really fit in.
Right. Well, you guys had, the original five had that chemistry. You were like friends from the beginning.
That chemistry wasn't there anymore.
Yeah.
It wasn't enjoyable. So he left.
So, yeah, and then, you know, that was basically, the band wrapped up for a while after that, like around 73.
Yeah. It was never the same after that, Mike, really. It was never the same after that. I only got that feeling again working with So What, that feeling I had with the Equals, working with Jason and the guys. I got that feeling back again.
So let's talk about that, yeah, because for anyone that's listening that didn't know about it, I mean, about 5 years ago, I think, you first connected with Jason.
2017. No, 16, actually. Jason wanted to contact me to write an article on the Equals, and I wasn't very interested, really. And he got hold of an agent that I did do some work for in Germany, And the agent gave him my number, and he contacted me. And I wasn't really up for it because, you know, I was getting really disillusioned with the whole thing. And between Jason and Jude, they pushed me and pushed me. I said, oh, okay. So we decided to have a meet. Jason was in London. We had a meeting, and he knew a lot about the Equals, and Jude liked him. And if Jude likes him, then that's it. If she likes somebody, I normally trust her judgment. She's normally very good at that.
Yeah.
So we decided to do the show in San Francisco at the Elbow Room. And when I met up with Jason 3 days or so before the gig and went to rehearsal, they knew all the songs that we wanted to do. Actually, they remembered some of them more than I did. And it was a great rehearsal. And came back to the hotel, I said to Jude, yeah, I think I'm going to enjoy this. Hey! So we did the gig, but the sad thing is, it was very, very enjoyable, but I had the flu. And I didn't realize how bad the flu was. I almost collapsed on stage. And for the first time in my life, halfway through a show, I had to come off stage and sat down for about 15 minutes and then went back on and completed the show. And everyone said it was a brilliant show, but sadly, I could have enjoyed it more than I should, you know, but having the flu, I mean, my voice wasn't 100%, felt fainty, you know, and at times I felt as if I was going to collapse, but I thought, no, you're a showman, if you're going to die, you've got to die instead. And the great thing with working with So What is, you work with other musicians, and you're never quite sure that they know what they're doing, and you haven't got that confidence in them. Everyone in that band, I have 100% confidence in them in what they're doing. They're brilliant musicians. And not only that, they are very nice people. And Mike, it is not very often that you find that.
No.
You know? There's always
one
or two that's not very pleasant. I find them very nice people. Jude loves them. I love them. You know, great musicians and great people. And to me, that's important.
Right, yeah.
Very important.
Yeah, especially if you've got to spend time with them and get in a van and drive and do all that stuff.
That's right. Traveling with them is a joy. But I've always had this thing. I'd love to travel in America, you know. And I got that opportunity, and so it was great. Yeah.
So how many cities did you play in?
On the first one, the first gig was just San Francisco. And then we did New Jersey and New York. Those were brilliant. And then we did the tour in the July, where we did San Diego with you. And we did Seattle.
We did LA, obviously, right?
Yeah, we did LA. Yeah. That was a good gig. I enjoyed your gig, actually. I really did.
The thing about the show that was so great is that you realized just how many fantastic songs the Equals had, because it was just one after another, and every song was like, oh yeah, this one, oh yeah, this one, and this one, you know, and then it was like, you were never going to run out, it kind of seemed. It was amazing.
No. Sometimes we have to hold, come on, Jason, can't do that many, you know, we can only do 19 songs, you know, but there's so many more that you could do. But the great thing about that is I love being close to the audience.
Yeah.
I don't really enjoy these big, you know, 10,000, 15,000 venues, you know. I love to be there with the audience, you know.
Right.
See the expression on their face, see the joy on their faces. To me, when you're doing these big venues, it's just a blur, you know. You don't really see a lot of faces. It's just a blur. But I love being close to the audience.
Right, getting that feedback right there, right directly.
That's right.
That's what it's all about, yeah.
And it makes me happy to make people happy. if you know what I mean.
Well, that's the purpose of it all, isn't it, really?
That's right. Well, I mean, I shouldn't be telling you. I mean, you know that. I mean, you do it all the time.
Yeah, but watching you, I could see that in such a extreme way. You know, you were just so happy to be performing, and that making the audience happy, and so it's just a kind of a feedback loop of that happiness and excitement. You know, that you could keep going, and it's really really magical. I mean, you're really a master of that. You know, you really understand.
One of the things that makes me happy is that 9 years ago, I was in hospital for 3 months in intensive care. I was diagnosed with, well, misdiagnosed. I had sepsis, and my own doctor and the hospital misdiagnosed me. So I was in hospital for 3 months. I couldn't walk. I could just about talk. I couldn't feed myself. I couldn't wash myself, I couldn't shave, I couldn't do anything. I had all these tubes in me, you know. So after coming out of that experience, I'm just grateful for every day. And the thing is, the year before, Jude was diagnosed with cancer, and she managed to survive that, you know. So every day to me is a blessing, Mike, you know. Every day is a great day.
Yeah, and you and Judith have been married for how long now?
54 years now.
54 years. Yeah. You are an inspiration in so many ways, you know.
It wasn't easy at first. she really gave me a hard time, you know, when I first met her. I mean, turning up, meeting her, wearing a mauve suit as well didn't exactly help. In the middle of one of the busiest railway stations in London. And people looking, I say, oh, it's one of the equals. Oh. it's a great union. She's a great person. Great mother. Very understanding. She looked after the children while I was, you know, on the road. And they love her to death. You know, so do I, really. And the funny thing is, my mother didn't like her. And her mother didn't like me. It came around.
I hope so. So what's your plans next? Are you hopefully going to be seeing you on stage
well,
again?
I'm hoping to do some stuff in America, you know. But I'm waiting to see what Jason's going to come up with, or if he's coming up with anything. But I really want to do some shows now, because it's been over 3 years now since I did the last gig.
I know people would love to see you again.
I would love to see people again. You know, no, I'm definitely going to try and do something this year. Skies above, but never, never fall.
Ugly Things Podcast was produced by James Archer and narrated by Mike Stacks. That's me. I've been publishing Ugly Things magazine now for 40 years, covering the best overlooked music of the 1960s and beyond. You can order the latest issue of the magazine at uglythings.com. That's ugly-things.com, where you can also order back issues, vinyl, CDs, and books, and read additional articles and reviews. Please subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, and tell your friends. We would also really appreciate it if you became a Patreon supporter. For just a small monthly donation, Patreon members get exclusive access to all kinds of interesting bonus content. Your contribution will help us keep bringing you the very best in 1960s beat, garage, and psychedelic music. I'd like to send out a personal thank you to our top Patreon supporters: Michael Barbera, Chip Lyon, Rob Brannigan, Ray Brandis, Stephen Schmidt, and Phil Payne. Thank you, all of you, for your support. And thank you for listening.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.